Do you generally like to know what's going on, what's happening next? When you don't know the answers to those two questions, do you struggle? I know I do. Do you struggle when there isn't a clear picture of why something is the way it is? Well, you're not alone. You and me both. Uncertainty, for me, has at points meant everything from annoyance, lost sleep, anxiety, all the way up to the pretty much the unraveling of my reality. But the freedom from those situations came from not pushing to try to have more certainty in my life by trying to be in control of more things or all the things that I was uncertain about. That's an implausible fantasy. It was impossible to fulfill. And it was a drive that was having me sprinting in 1,000 directions at once and going nowhere, exhausting myself and not really doing anything. The freedom from that discomfort that I just described, it comes from learning how to be with and maintaining my ability to be with uncertainty. In his new book, The New Rule Book, psychologist and author Chris Cheers writes that, and I quote, "Embracing uncertainty is not about eliminating fear, but about learning to dance with it, recognizing that life's greatest lessons often emerge from the unknown." Chris has written a great book, and you know what? Chris is a great chat, and you are going to hear Chris and I talk about all kinds of things today, and I know you're going to like it. We have to play some ads to pay for it all, so stay with me. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Don't share your emotions here. This is not the time for it. You know, boys don't cry. Now's not the time. No need to get upset. You know, this isn't the time to be angry. We receive the messages time and time again that these uncomfortable emotions are bad, and you need to do something to control or distract yourself from them. But it doesn't work. They still come back because they're there for a reason. You know, these, and I think this is what I try and get to in the book, is that it's not about trying to get rid of these emotions. It's actually about trying to change our attitude towards them.
That is Australian psychologist and author Chris Cheers. This is Osher Ginsberg, Better Than Yesterday. Hello and welcome. Thanks for being a part of the show. This is Better Than Yesterday. It's a podcast here to make your day-to-day better than yesterday. That's it. That's what the show's been doing since 2013 through conversations we've been having from people all over the world, from all walks of life, some of them experts in their field. Each one of those chats has left certainly me, and I definitely know the people that write and jump in on the Discord, with something to think about and help move towards a little more ammo in the growth of who we are as humans. Because what are we without if we're not growing? All life grows. Even a 1,000-year-old tree grows. Why not take charge of which direction we're growing in? And that's what the podcast is all about. I'm Osher Ginsberg. I'm a podcaster. I'm a TV host. I'm a dad. I'm a stepdad. I'm a get up early in the morning, drop kid to work, come back and train guy. I'm a unsuccessfully trying to clandestinely sneak my son out of the house to go and buy a present for Mother's Day kind of guy. And then when I got back, was like, oh, why didn't I get an invite? Why didn't you guys ask me? I would have loved to have come. And then my face just says shit. It's like, what's your face saying? And my face said some more shit. Like, I haven't said a thing. It's like, what were you? Oh. Like, I can't get anything past Audrey, I tell you, man. And so, yeah, that's who I am. If you want to come and say hi to me in person, I'd love you to come and check out. We're doing two live shows on the 19th, this Friday, at the Factory Theatre in Marrickville. We're playing The Big Room, very exciting, part of the Sydney Comedy Festival, for NTNN, NNN, Real Stories, Fake News. It's the fake news show that we've been doing around the country. It's tons of fun. It's super duper. It'll be the last one we do for a while in Sydney. So I'd really love you to be there. It's an important show for us because I'm cutting the pilot right now. We're very close to pitching it. And this particular show that we're doing, this live show, is important for us because the people that we want to buy it are going to be there. So come and laugh lots. If you can't afford to come, let me know. I would rather lose money on a seat with someone laughing in it than lose money on an empty seat that is essentially a comedy black hole. So you've got my email. Send us your email at gmail.com. Also, jump on the Discord server. Both those links are in the show notes and the links for the tickets as well. We're also playing in Newcastle, 5:30 p.m., right after Mid-Flight Brawl. If you listen to Nick and Luke, one of my favorite podcasts, Mid-Flight Brawl, we're on right after the boys, part of the Newcastle Comedy Festival, June 3rd. Come check us out. Tickets are in the show notes. Let me tell you about my guest today. Chris Cheers is a psychologist and an author based in Melbourne, Australia, and he's spent over 20 years now, helping people understand their minds and overcome the challenges of life. You know, the kind of things that get people in the door at a psychologist's office. You never walk in when everything's fine. You walk in when things are a bit shit and you can't figure it out for yourself. As a psychologist, Chris has worked with all kinds of people from right across the spectrum of our community, all people from all kinds of backgrounds, socioeconomic status, and sexuality. Now, on top of his day job, Chris is a prolific writer, writes a lot of articles. He's speaks quite a bit. He works really hard because he's quite passionate and spreads his message of positive mental health and well-being to both professionals and punters like you and I. And Chris has just written a new book. It's called The New Rule Book. There you go. The New Rule Book. That's the name of the book. Now, in this book, Chris writes about, you know, how to embrace uncertainty, roll with the punches, the things that life throws at us, try to be with it all. Using his experience as a mental health professional and backed up by the latest research. I'm a science guy. I like stuff that's backed by latest research. Chris shares some really useful tips and really points out a couple of fantastically handy ways to become more resilient, more adaptable, more emotionally intelligent in this ever-changing world that you and I both live in. Now, you can't have a conversation like this without talking about the sticky stuff. So all in context, I promise you, and with, you know, every intent of having these conversations with a means to an end, we do speak about trauma, we speak about suicide and self-harm. But as I said, it's mentioned in passing, it's mentioned in context, so I wanted you to be aware. I hope you enjoy this chat with Chris Cheers. Chris, hello. Thanks for coming.
Hello.
How do you do?
No worries, Osha. Great to be here. I'm good. And yourself?
Mate, I'm good. But I forgot to take my meds. So you're getting me unmedicated. So that's interesting. So we'll see we'll see what happens here. And what about you? How's your day been, Chris?
Pretty good. I've flown into Sydney, so I'm here for World Pride things. I've flown right into big queer, amazing culture, and was out last night at a huge event, and yeah, just feeling great to be here.
Mate, it's beautiful. Mate, some people, I did a work thing the other night, some folks were over from London, and I was just trying to tell them, like, it's just the most profound party masquerading as something way, way, way more important. You know, it's not like New Orleans Mardi Gras, which is let's drink yard glasses of
of Tanqueray and orange juice and just get munted. It's, yeah, I look fabulous. I've been training all year. I've got no body fat. And the reason I'm here is because I need you to see that I'm here and recognize my humanity, please. And it's fucking, that's the underlying part of it. And it's, I think every event that I've ever been to around Mardi Gras, and I'm sure the same with World Pride, has the same baseline. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, these party spaces, these queer spaces are where we make our identity. So to do that on such a scale with so many people just coming together, and as you said, just like, this is who we are and we're here and, yeah, and we're big and proud. It's amazing to be part of.
Yeah. And you very kindly let me read a copy of your book quite early, and I'm very, very grateful for that. It came out of something that we all went through. You can't see any of your friends or family lockdown times. And I guess, you know, during that time you were putting a lot of really interesting information out there and a lot of what they call psychoeducation, which certainly in my journey made all the things that were happening to me feel a lot less scary. So, you know, let me ask you, as a psychologist, what's the, you know, why is psychoeducation so important?
I think it's about making these ideas for our mental health and well-being accessible. You know, the idea of psychoeducation is it's something that, you know, I can share on Instagram, we can put in a book, we can teach in a lecture, but it's something that, because it's en masse, because it's something we can communicate to a lot of people at once, I think the amazing thing about psychoeducation is it something that makes these ideas accessible. And it's also often replacing the stuff we didn't learn at school that maybe we needed to, about our emotions, about how to have relationships, about these really important parts of being, you know, human and being an adult. I think psychoeducation can sometimes fill that gap and really present these strategies that can help anyone's mental health and well-being.
When you're dealing with clients who may not know, you know, they come to see you, their GPs refer them to you, and you're seeing them and they're like, yeah, my throat feels like it's closing over. I'm taking antacid, but nothing's working and my stomach hurts all the time. And you explain to them what anxiety is and you explain to them how the ongoing effects of it can lead to these things. Do you see a sense of relief come over them? Like when they, understand what's going on?
Yeah, because I think that is a release from the feeling that it's their fault or that there's something wrong with them. I think that's the really important part about psychoeducation, is when you can tell someone that this is what you're going through and it's normal and it's something a lot of people go through, it immediately releases people of that feeling that they're faulty or that there's this thing that they're not allowed to talk to anyone about. I think that's the really important part of it's the validation and then the hope then that comes from that. Because as soon as we can name and make sense of our experience, what comes straight after that is the hope that we can get better or that we can change it. And I think that's the important part of any sort of psychoeducation or any sort of just helping someone understand how their mental health, how their well-being relates to their physical health and how all those things connect.
It's the idea for me that, you know, these things rhyme, so they suck, but they work. Yeah, to name it, to tame it, right? So, my heart's racing, my hands are shaking, my breath is really, I'm in fight or flight. Okay. And for me, the moment, if I can be self-aware enough, sometimes when I'm flooded, I can't. If I'm aware enough to be able to name it, instantaneously, I'm no longer it. Now I'm just dealing with it. It's like, I'm going about my day making my toast or whatever, and this thing is happening, versus I am being controlled by this thing. And that in itself happened to me this morning, you know, in the middle of a flood. I'm like, okay, this is what's happening. Okay. You know, I was able to disengage from a situation before I said something I regretted.
It's the naming it, the labeling it, or just being able to talk about our experiences. As soon as we put these things into language, it changes our experience of them. They suddenly move from something perhaps overwhelming to something that we understand, that we then know how to sort of process. And I think stress and anxiety is a really, you know, important one, because sometimes I think we feel like the way to out of stress is to fix the problem, is to find the cause and fix the problem or to talk about the stress. But I think the other way to view stress is that stress is a physiological, system of the body. It's a normal, natural process for us to feel stress. And the way that we process stress or move through stress sometimes isn't about talking about it. Sometimes isn't about, finding the cause, because sometimes the cause of the stress is totally out of our control. So why it's so important to move it back to, oh, hang on, this stress is happening in my body, is because we can then process it through our body, through exercise, through, whether it's vigorous exercise or yoga or going for a walk, going for a cycle. These sort of ways of using our body to process stress is how we then return our body to complete that stress cycle. And understanding that can make, a huge difference to people's lives and to how they work with their stress and anxiety.
And certainly I think about if you're a parent of a kid who has some, is differently abled. It's not like you're going to be able to cure the cause or fix the cause of that stress. Like, no, I'm just going to have to go through life and never, ever go into a building with stairs. Okay, all right, we'll figure this out. And learning how to manage that and learning how to absorb that and be with that and understanding that you can cope with the right strategies is I think the key to the hope you mentioned before, knowing that with the right amount of tools and putting those tools in place, knowing to use them and actually using them, life can be...
Which are two separate things, yeah.
Two very separate things. A lot of the work that you did that certainly brought you to my attention, I saw what you were doing before I was connected to you for this, is on this platform that can at once have extraordinarily powerful information that is backed by rigorous research and, backed up by evidence, and the same font with the same background with the same thing can have something written there that is just, whoa, that's bad. So when we are scrolling away and we see these platitudes come by, how can we tell the difference between what's actually useful for us and what could be not so great?
I think it's about trying to understand who wrote the thing, right? It's the same as if you were going to go to a doctor or a psychologist or a counselor. You want to know who's writing the thing and what kind of education or what kind of background they have. And I think that should be your first port of call. But then secondly, I think we can try to take a moment to think about when we read these things, if it's actually helping us. I think we sometimes get lost in just sharing or just doing what's popular or just kind of reading the thing that maybe makes us feel good in the moment. But I think the telltale of any good strategy when it comes to mental health and well-being is, what is it doing for you in the long term? Because sometimes maybe something might feel good to read in the short term or might feel good to, to whatever it says might make you in that moment feel like this has, changed everything. But try and notice what these strategies give you in the long term. And I think that can be the telltale sign. Who wrote it? Make sure they're qualified. And then also, what is it doing for you in the long term?
And I can only imagine that seeing enough of these things go by in your own scrolling and your own observation of what was out there led you to go, actually, I have to do something about this. For example, the book, which is fantastic, this idea of I'm having a self-care day. It's all about self-care, this, that, and the other. As someone in recovery, if I want to help myself, I help another person. If I'm having a shit time, if I need something, I'll go give something to somebody else. And that's real key of being in recovery, being of service to someone. And the way you spoke about self-care really reminded me of that. I'm wondering if you could expand on that for us.
Yeah, I wanted to reflect in the book, and something that I see, in the culture is sort of how where self-care has ended up. I think it's important to remember that self-care, back in the 70s was something from a black feminist sort of queer movement. Like, for them, self-care was political warfare. Self-care was about doing things for yourself so you could rise up against systems and you could change the world and you could care for your community because you're looking after yourself. But as I looked around today, I think self-care has got a whole new meaning. And I think it's become sort of subsumed by this idea that we can ourselves fix ourselves, and it should be our responsibility to fix ourselves. So that idea that, if you're not doing well, or your work's not going well, your relationship's not going well, if you just do enough self-care, you'll be better. And I think the issue with that is that it's focusing so much on self that you might be missing out on the fact that there's external things around you to begin with that might make it difficult for you to do your self-care. If you're from a minority or another marginalized community, it's going to be difficult for you to look after yourself, to rise up against these systems. And sometimes we might think that, oh, well, that's going to make us give up. But I think the other side of that coin is, no, it gives us compassion that it is harder for us. And that's why, you know, it is difficult sometimes for us to look after ourselves. I think the other thing that might be missed when we focus so much on self, you know, I do think self-care has sort of become a bit too much about self, is we start to view the world in terms of there's things we can do for self and things we can do for others. And like they're two totally different things. And it misses this giant, really important middle bit, which you're talking about, that when you do things for others, you're also doing things for yourself. When you do things for your community, for your family, it's not just for them. You feel it as well. This is what I talk to in the book. I call it us care. But these are the ideas of community care that have been, you know, literally here for tens of thousands of years in First Nations communities, especially. This idea that when we do things for other people, it helps our own mental health and well-being as well. And I think self-care needs to absolutely be the first step, but it shouldn't be the last step when it comes to, you know, improving our mental health and well-being.
It's interesting that we're a communal species. We're a cooperative species. It's undeniable that there are bits of our brains and levels of happiness that can only be unlocked through caring for other people. And the only meaningful and long-lasting happiness that I've ever experienced, Chris, is in being of service to others and being helpful. I can buy, oh, I've got a new silicon case for my AirPods, happiness for a good 47 seconds. Then it's a fucking thing, you know? Gone.
It's just stuff. And I invite people in the book to, like, imagine if we just took away all the stuff, if we just took away everything, if we took away all the expectations around you telling you that you have to go to work or you have to live like this, your relationship has to look like that. If we just removed all the expectations, what would be left with that would be our core needs as humans? And I think human connection is the core need. You know, social connection is a core need. And when we start questioning, hang on, have we set up a society that caters predominantly for that core need? I think the answer often is no. Like that we've taken this detour that so much of what surrounds us is sort of being taken over by this idea of work or money or to live a particular way. And I think the lockdown and the pandemic, I think, has really shown us, because so many people were in that place of isolation, or I think now social media and the internet, you know, people are starting to question, hang on, is having thousands of friends on Instagram or Facebook, is that the same as social connection, or am I still feeling lonely? I think we talk about this so much loneliness and so much isolation in the world right now. Irvin Yalom, who's a psychoanalyst, used to say that, you know, isolation is the universal symptom. And that leading from that, then connection becomes the universal cure. And I think part of finding our way back, you know, post sort of lockdowns and in this current climate, I think we're all trying to find a way back to life that maybe is focused a bit more on connection rather than maybe on all the expectations of how we're meant to live our lives.
Yeah, there's misery in comparison. There truly, truly is. And, you know, it's said around body image that 30 years ago, I, as a man, maybe I would buy a men's, like, not a men's magazine, not a gentleman's magazine, but like a fitness magazine. I would be exposed to maybe like three images of a man that I related to with way better body than mine, maybe twice a year, and go, oh, I should probably hit the gym more. All right. I will see three images of a man around my age that I relate to with a similar vibe. If I'm sitting on Instagram, I will see those three images in 90 seconds, you know? Every fucking day,
like,
and to deal with that amount of envy or attack on my self-worth, we might not be prepared for that, and it can be really I don't think we're built for that. We certainly don't prepare ourselves for that, because you know, envy is and comparison is a part of being human. It's a part of one of the things that makes us, oh, that looks like a better way to be. I might go and try that. That I wouldn't mind a bit of that. That looks like a tasty meal, or that person looks like they're moving well, or that looks like a nice house, or they look like they're really in love with their family. I wouldn't mind getting to that place. It's needed, you know, to inspire us to action, but too much of it can be just destructive, man.
And when you say we're not built for it, I think that's a really important point, is that from an evolutionary perspective, you know, we're built to connect to people, but we're not built to connect to thousands and thousands of people. You know, we're built to connect. I talk about this in the book, you know, that Robert Dunbar has done a lot of work in this space, that we're meant to connect with about 150 people total, and of them about 14 should be kind of close, intimate, you know, people that we would, you know, rely on to look after our children. A lot of people on social media have thousands and thousands and thousands of connections. And your brain, it's built to compare. It's built to categorize when it comes to social. It's built to compete. It's built to do all these things in small social groups. Absolutely. So you've kind of put your brain, which is just built to deal with competition, absolutely, comparison, absolutely, but only on the kind of a much smaller scale. And what the internet has done, or what social media has done, is kind of put these brains that are built to find threat in social environments. You know, your brain is so programmed to find threat because basically the person, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, if you can pick out the threats early, you're going to survive. So your brain sits there ready to find the threat. And it's like social media is this exquisite machine that can just throw up possible threats everywhere in terms of, social comparison, or in terms of sharing something and how many people are going to respond. And I think maybe it has taken us over, you know, without us really considering the long-term impact it's really having, not only on, you know, social connection, on what we view relationships are, on how we start relationships, but also, you know, in terms of our attention and where we're getting gratification and all these things. It's quite literally changing our brains. And the beauty there is that we can change them back, but it does require action.
Yeah, neuroplasticity is the superpower of humanity. It's the thing that sets us apart from anything else. You mentioned getting taken over, because there's a part of the book that really goes into this idea about emotions, and about we need to be in control of our reactions, and we need to be in control of our responses. And while there is some merit to that, because we don't want to be reactionary, or we don't want to be lashing out in anger, there's a few steps before that around being with the feeling. I say it all the time. Susan David, she's amazing. She's been on the show twice. Uncomfortable feelings are the price of admission to a meaningful life. And, you know, you do speak to that. You do speak about, like, just learn to be okay with when it doesn't feel very good. And this may sound like quite confronting to some people.
Yeah. And to, I think, every client, every workshop, everything I've ever done in my life, the undercurrent is make me happy. You know, do the thing that will make me happy. And the unfortunate thing that I have to guide people through is that the aim of life can never to be happy if your version of happy is to not feel uncomfortable. You know, if you want me to give you the strategy or the book or that will make you never feel uncomfortable emotions, you know, anxiety or anger, you know, that's never going to be a helpful goal, merely because it's not possible. And we've all tried probably to get rid of these emotions, to get rid of these uncomfortable feelings. You know, we drink, we eat, we exercise, we therapy, we do all these things to try and control these emotions. And we grow up in a culture that tells us we can, you know, or tells us that don't share your emotions here. This is not the time for it. You know, boys don't cry. Now's not the time. No need to get upset. You know, this isn't the time to be angry. We receive the messages time and time again that these uncomfortable emotions are bad and you need to do something to control or distract yourself from them. But it doesn't work. They still come back because they're there for a reason. You know, these, and I think this is what I try and get to in the book, is that it's not about trying to get rid of these emotions. It's actually about trying to change our attitude towards them so that they can become seen as a normal part of life. And I think one of the most important parts there is to just remember that emotions are part of you. You know, they're a physiological system of your body that are there for a reason. They can't be an enemy or a threat because they're in you. And then the second attitude that I really try and invite people to consider is, if these emotions are evolved, they're there for a reason, that means uncomfortable emotions are there for a reason, you know? So next time you're feeling, you know, frustrated, angry, notice that that might guide you towards taking important action in your life. Next time you're feeling stressed or anxious, maybe that's telling you, oh, you're doing something new here. You need to, you know, be aware of this, focus on this. Jealousy, you were talking about before, envy, can be an amazing path to knowing what you want from life, because we get jealous about things that maybe we're not doing for ourselves that maybe we could. All these emotions, when we give them space, are there for a reason. I think that idea is wonderful. And as Susan David writes about, you know, that idea of emotional agility is an incredible idea, to be compassionate and curious towards our emotions. I think the difficult thing is, how do you learn how to do it? You know, how do you move from that theory to actually do it in practice? And every day, I reckon, I use a strategy that of how to do this that I write about in the book, which is, when you're feeling an emotion, you know, ask yourself three questions. Go inward. What am I feeling? Try and label it. You know, what is this emotion? Secondly, why does it make sense that I feel like this? And third, what do I need? And those three questions, when you just do those on repeat, will change your relationship with your emotions, because your emotions, rather than this thing that you need to control or distract, and it doesn't work out that way anyway, emotions, before any other thought, before any other cognition, emotions are the thing that help you make sense of the world around you. So in times of uncertainty, you know, we keep talking about that as this, where we're at right now. How do we make decisions in a great resignation about where to go next in our life? How do we make decisions about whether this is the relationship for us? How do we make decisions about what a meaningful life looks like to us? And the answer is always, listen to your emotions, because your emotions are going to tell you what is meaningful and are going to tell you what the right decisions are for you. We just maybe don't give them enough space to, you know, really be heard.
I get when your clients or the workshops are like, I just need it to feel better. There's got to be a point though, when you need to start as a, you know, investigating, why is this a chronic thing? Why is this never going away? And to, you know, talk to another previous guest of the show, Johan Hari, I adore his work. His work on addiction and his work on connecting with others is astounding. The idea that anxiety is a signal that something's up. And something's not exactly right. At what point do you think, when do we start to look at it like, this is an okay amount of anxiety, this is an okay amount of fear, and it's something I've certainly been through. When, in your mind, is it, okay, now this is a little too much, we need to either see what's like, are you in the wrong job, are you in the wrong relationship, do you need to go for me, do we need to get you up to a psychiatrist, do we need to, like, at what point do you think, what are some signs that people might need, like, to go kind of to the next level of intervention?
I think it's learnt through taking action and seeing if it helps or not. You know, if you are using these strategies of, you know, completing the stress cycle through exercise, if you're looking after, you know, your body and how you nourish it and how you move it, if you are trying to listen to your emotions, if you are processing them, if you're journaling, if you are talking to people about how you're feeling, if you're doing all these things and it doesn't seem to be making any difference, or it doesn't seem to be helping, that's, I think, the point where you can maybe reach out for support, reach out to a psychologist, reach out for medication, reach out for whatever tool is going to be helpful for you. But I think the real kind of challenging thing here is it comes from trying things out first. I think we spend so much of our life often thinking, okay, well, which is the best thing to do? And then I'm going to do that one. And then we spend a lot of time trying to consider, is that the thing that's going to help me? Is that the thing that's going to help me? But I think just trying out something, trying out small changes to your life and doing that consistently, that's the thing that can sort of start to make a change. And I think when it comes to emotions, whether it be, you know, chronic anxiety or whether it be other, you know, emotions that are really overwhelming, I think it's really important to remember that emotions are always a temporary state. You know, sometimes when we start giving them language like they're chronic, like that we have an anxiety disorder, that we, you know, have depression. I'm not saying that these terminologies aren't validating and helpful, but when we start talking about our emotional state as if it's chronic, or at least it's as if it's constant, that can change our experience of it. And I think this is the really important part about emotions. How we talk about our emotions changes our experience of those emotions. So if it's really important, no matter how you're feeling, to really remember that it is a temporary state. And there's research that suggests that emotions last 90 seconds. That's all. Everything after that is our attitude towards them. But the actual physiological state of that emotion is about 90 seconds. Obviously, another emotion can come after, and another emotion can come after. But that's all caused by our attitude towards the first one. So if we can process and allow the first one to pass and accept the first one, do the hard work that is to know, okay, this is anxiety, this is temporary, this is here, what can I do to process it? What can I do in my body to process it? The more we can do that, we can really change these things from a chronic state to just temporary states that we can manage.
How do you speak? Because this is a concept. I was lucky enough to, and I say it, I consider it a great gift that I was in New York on September 11. I got shitty PTSD and I couldn't look people in the eye and I was all fucking weird. And because of that, I got taught from a lovely psychologist called Phil, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is not, I mean, it's very biased towards my existence and my perception of the world coming from a kind of a white Western kind of view of the world, and certainly time doesn't, you know, it's not the same for everyone. Time doesn't exist in the same way for many cultures, but that's another conversation. But the idea at first, I was quite challenged, Chris, by the idea that, hang on, my thought isn't a fact. What? Because I've never had any cause to question that. For people who might be struggling with the idea of, hang on, this thing or this person or this boss is such a bastard, that's the reason I'm shitty, not because of me, it's them. To talk to them as that, actually, if you change the way you think about that person, it will change how your body feels. Like, that's a humongous leap that you need to let go of ego. You have to be humble. You have to, like, that's a hard thing to get to. How do you walk people towards that?
Well, the first step before we start to even notice that our thoughts aren't facts or look for evidence for our thoughts, before we get to that state, the most important skill we can learn for our mental health and well-being, I think, is the ability to notice our thoughts and emotions. That's the first bit. And that's the bit that a lot of us don't develop or don't naturally kind of consider, is the idea that we have thoughts, that we can notice these thoughts, and that these things are not, you know, us, that they're not kind of who we are. That there's these things that come up in our mind, these thoughts, these temporary states again. Noticing them is the first step. After that, I think, you know, you can pull up with that idea of, is that, I, rather than saying thoughts are not facts, sometimes I consider the idea of, you know, is this thought helpful? You know, just writing a thought down or noticing a thought, just asking yourself that question, you know, is this helpful? And then the next bit is helpful for what? And to which I always say a meaningful life, you know, is this thought helpful for a meaningful life? And you get to obviously define what that meaningful life looks like. But that's how we can start to view our thoughts, not as things we must do, or not as, you know, as you said, truths or the thing that must lead us. I think one of the helpful thing that I do every day is I have a little technique where I always say, thanks, brain, but I've got this.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned that my brain, you know, I've learned through studies of psychology, I've learned through sitting with hundreds of clients, I've learned through my own life and experience. My brain is not built to help me live a meaningful life. My brain is built to categorize people, to keep things at homeostasis, and to avoid threats. So if it's beautiful, that my brain's favorite day is a day where I don't do anything that is going to cause any risk to myself. I don't do anything new. and I avoid uncomfortable emotions as much as possible. And if I just do that all the time, my brain's going to be like, sweet, we're living great here. The problem is that kind of life of avoidance doesn't lead to a meaningful life. My brain is no ally in the quest for a meaningful life. Mm. And the more we can notice that, the more we can start to go, okay, thanks, brain. I know you're trying to help me. I like to see my brain almost as like a really, really, a friend that thinks they're really, really helpful. So they mean well, but in the end, they're actually just helping you avoid life rather than live it. And they're always there, and they're always that voice that maybe is telling you to avoid the thing, to not do the thing. So the more we can develop this relationship with our thoughts that's like, thanks, brain, I know you're trying to help me here, but this thing is meaningful to me. And I do that all the time, you know, thinking about if I'm tired or if I'm feeling anxious or I'm feeling stressed, like coming to this podcast today, you know, I was feeling a bit heightened, you know, this is a new thing to talk about these ideas and this sort of public facing. What I will feel anxious. And I will always say, hang on, I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling stressed about this. Am I willing to feel those emotions in order to do this thing that's meaningful? And if the answer is yes, this thing is meaningful, then I have to allow space for those emotions. I have to process them, to understand them. But I choose to do the thing anyway because it's meaningful. And it's the same with my thoughts. If my thoughts are telling me not to do something, but then I say, hang on, but is this thing meaningful to me? Is this thing looks like a meaningful life? Then I have to notice those thoughts. Thanks, brain. But I have to do this thing anyway.
For one, it's great to hear you say that because it sounds very familiar. And B, I'm noticing that my... because it sounds exactly the same thing that I do, and I'm noticing that inside me is like, oh, fuck, I thought I was special. Like, no, I'm not. It's the same shit as everybody.
Yeah.
It's the same fucking thing.
I often say that we're all, because I've got to sit, obviously, you know, with hundreds of people where they, you know, it's such a privileged place where they tell me their deepest, you know, the things they've never told anyone. And the thing that I wish everyone could experience is being in my chair, where you get to see that everyone is so similar. When we talk about the deep, dark thing that we don't want to tell anyone, everyone experiencing that. And it's really hard, but the baseline, we all feel that we're not worthy. We all feel that we're not good enough. And I think the more we can connect to that and find the shared compassion in that, and talk about that, we can start to realize that that's just our beliefs. Everyone is worthy, you know? Everyone is lovable. Everyone is good enough. But we need to notice these beliefs and talk about them so we can really start challenging them.
You mentioned the idea of being willing to be with this discomfort in the search and in the purpose of something that is meaningful towards me. The analog, like I just trained and I did Renegade Rows, which are really hard considering all the surgery and shit I've been through. My vision goes blurry. I start to strobe. I think I'm going to fall over. But the hormone release and the adaptation that my body does, and then the, you know, turning on the way my body moves and reinvigorating the parts that, like, hopefully soon I'll be able to walk in a straight line again. I can't really walk in a straight line at the moment. And I'm willing to be with all of that. Like, if you said to me, you're going to have your vision blurred and you're not going to be able to hear for half a second because your blood pressure's at that point and you're not going to be able to breathe and your entire upper body's going to hurt, I'd be like, I don't think I want that. But it's in the purpose of something further. But so I talk about this a bit, but it, for me, it's no different. It's just up here. It's between my ears. And being willing to be with a certain level of discomfort in the search or with the idea of a more meaningful pursuit, how does that, you know, kind of move into the way we work and what we do for money? Like it or not, we live in a society where we need money. We need money to buy things, houses, clothes, food, health insurance, Netflix subscriptions. We need all these things, all right? How does meaning find its way into that? And I'm very lucky in that I have managed to pursue a career that has great meaning for me. But if we're in a gig that we might not feel that great about, how can we find meaning in that gig?
I think it's about thinking about work as a space where you can enact who you are rather than being who you are. You know, whatever your job is, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, there will be a capacity for you within that there will be some freedom. You know, there will be some freedom in how you act, and there'll be some ability to act in a way that aligns with the kind of person you want to be. You know, whether that be in how you're treating the people around you, or how you're treating, you know, customers or clients, or how you are being creative in your work, or some sense of agency. But this is, I guess, a really important point about that's a really needed thing within work. So if you are a leader, or if you are running sort of any businesses or anything, I can promise you the number one thing that will kill a workforce is if they don't feel like they have any freedom or agency in their role. People need to have a sense that they can enact creativity, they can enact themselves, they can be their authentic selves, and they can bring something to the table. So we need to make sure that we create that in our jobs. And then no matter what our job is, we're able to rest at night asking ourselves that question of, you know, how was I today the kind of person that I want to be in life, you know, yeah, with the people I was with? And I think that's the way to consider how you can live meaningfully no matter what the work is. But I think the other huge part of this is, you know, you said before that we need money, and I absolutely know that's the truth. And I really understand too, when people are working from a place of fear or threat, you know, people are working to be able to keep a roof over their head. People are working to be able to feed their kids. You know, there is a privilege here when we talk about meaningful work and when we talk about finding purpose within our work. But I think it's also true to consider that it's not actually money that we need. It's shelter, you know, safety, food, and social connection, you know, these core needs, that's what we need. And I think we always have to question the culture that exists around us that is telling us that the only way to do that is money, or that a particular amount of money is what we need, or that we always need more money. I think it is good to step back from life every so often and think about not just the answer is being more money or climbing up the career ladder, but stepping back and thinking, how do I provide those things for myself or my family? You know, how can I live an authentic life, live a personal life, a purposeful life, but also provide not money, not just make money. How can I provide shelter and safety and social connection? Because it will allow us to not just prioritize money all the time. You know, it is just as important sometimes to offer social connection and care for your loved ones as it is to make money. And I think we do have to step back and consider a balance in all these things rather than just focus on one thing.
Speaking of loved ones, you do touch on this in the book in quite a lovely way. Is there a parallel between I'm willing to be with uncomfortable emotions to have a meaningful life? We tend to ever speak about that with our intimate partners or our kids. I'm willing to be with when you're really fucking annoying because I want a meaningful connection with you. Like the idea that it's a fallacy that it's always chocolate, strawberries, and balcony sex. It's not sometimes, but not. That's really hard to deal with for some people.
Parenting is a willingness, absolutely, a willingness to go through so much for this little person. And it's something that we don't know how to do. You know, we don't get the guidebook there. We're just kind of making it up as we go along. But there's a huge willingness to process our emotions, to sit with our emotions, to be willing to feel, or to be able to be willing to do this in order for my child or in order for the family. You know, what is parenting if not willingness? Absolutely. But I think the important part when we start talking about love and when we start talking about connections is that social connection, true, authentic love, you know, which I define in the book as love being the actions of belonging, of connection, and of safety. Love is not something we find. You know, we kind of grow up with this idea that love is, you know, this thing that one day we'll just be walking along and we'll fall in it, we'll fall deeply in it, and then we'll be happily ever after. I think that really means that we're not noticing that love is something that we do. And it also means that we're focusing a lot of romantic love sometimes in life, you know, the search for the one, rather than the idea that love, the actions of belonging, connection, safety, these things that make us better physiologically, you know, physical health, mental health, these actions of social connection are things we can do, not just with the one, but with our family, with our friends. And the number one way that you can connect meaningfully and authentically with someone is through the expression and the validation of emotion. If you are ever going through a challenging relationship, you know, of conflict, of distance, I think it's really important to understand that distance is what kills relationships, not conflict. And it's this really frustrating thing I see. I work with couples. I have two partners. I've worked with families for years, and I see it all the time. In relationships, we avoid talking about vulnerable things because we think that is what's going to end the relationship, when it's the total opposite. The talking about emotions, the talking about and being in the vulnerable place, that's not a threat to the relationship. That's often the one thing that will save a relationship, because relationships end through distance. And the more we can talk about emotions and validate those emotions for our partners, for our family, for our friends, that's what, you know, begets this beautiful kind of social connection that we're all searching for and needing. But unfortunately, it requires a willingness to feel those uncomfortable emotions as you talk to your partners or your family or your friends about your vulnerable and emotional states. But every time, you can see, it's almost like in a conflict. If in the middle of a conflict or a fight, if you just said, I just want to take a time out here. I know that we're fighting right now. I know we're feeling a lot of, you know, anger, but I just want to say that underneath this, I love you and I'm here for you and I support you. But I know that we're feeling these things right now. So let's just talk about what we need right now to make this the most useful conversation. That kind of vulnerability changes everything. It's hard won, but I think it's the kind of thing that can really make long-term relationships and family relationships really worthwhile.
Look, you dropped something in there, Chris, which I don't want to walk by, because what you just said, everything you just said was incredible. And everything you just said was like, I related to incredibly, and it would take work and focus to be as good as what you described when it comes to interacting with my wife, and having been in relationships that haven't worked out. I was married before. I know how much hard work it is and what it takes to have that, you know, that connection, that belonging, that safety with one person.
Yep.
What kind of Olympic gymnast work do you have to do, Chris, to maintain that with two partners?
Look, work is probably the right word. It is an action. You know, it's a willingness. I think and it's what I talk about in the book is, yes, I mean, I have two partners. You know, I call them partners. I'm engaged to one. The other is a partner. But what I really like to try and encourage is actually sort of removing the hierarchies here of that your romantic relationships are somehow more important or different than your other relationships. You know, takes just as much effort for me to have two partners as it does to be able to maintain a relationship with parents, with siblings, with kids, with best friends. All these things should be viewed as equal in their capacity for us to love. And what I mean by that, each of these are spaces where we can carry out actions of belonging, connection, and safety. But I would say that my path into understanding that almost has been being polyamorous, almost has been being part. Because when you get a second partner, it forces you to really think about how you're using your time. How are you showing up for your partners? Because it brings it so conscious, because so much of being poly or having multiple partners, you know, it's often just about scheduling, to be honest. It's just about making sure you're seeing each person enough, you're being there for each person enough, you're showing up enough. And it's almost like having the new partner has been my way to really consider that in a really conscious, mindful way. How am I showing up for my partners? Because I think what's happened in the past when I've just had one partner for years is you almost aren't so mindful of it anymore. You're just kind of in the relationship, but you're not actually thinking about how am I showing up for this partner? When are we going on dates? How am I showing my love? How am I showing them my appreciation? Having the second partner, you become more mindful of that, and you become more mindful of that in all your relationships. And I think that's been what poly has kind of meant to me, is it's this incredibly challenging, difficult thing because it means that I'm doing something that's against expectation. Absolutely. You know, conversations with my parents were fun and exciting to kind of explain that idea. Every time you get invited to something, you know, explaining that a plus two is, why is that needed? All these sorts of things. It goes against what's expected. But I think this is the beautiful thing of being queer or being poly, is we get to write our own rules for love. We get to construct the relationship that works for us. And whilst I'm not saying everyone should be queer and everyone should be poly, it's, you know, or everyone should be non-monogamous, you know, you should be whatever works for you. But I am asking people to be queer in the sense that you should question all the expectations that are already telling you. Don't let me tell you what to do, but question all the things that are around you that are telling you what kind of relationship you should have, what, in what way you should be with your partners or partner. And question those expectations and try to just sit down with your partner or partners and say, what works for us? How can we show up for each other? And kind of question all those expectations around you that are telling you that you need to be with your loved ones in a particular way.
And I would just invite people listening at this moment, Chris, to kind of notice what's going on in their head right now. Notice how they might be thinking about what you've just described. Notice how they may be perhaps judging the relationship that you've just described with these two people. Notice how they might be thinking about the conversation with your parents that you just described. And then also notice that you're listening to someone who clearly thinks a lot about this stuff and clearly has the emotional safety of everyone involved at the top of mind. It clearly is all about consent and agency, and understand that, you know, I would invite you to just kind of like in no other way would you want myself or to Chris to talk about your relationship or judge your relationship, you know, just offer the same, because I think it's an important moment to have this, because we kind of touched on this on the most recent series of The Bachelors that we did, and we didn't have time to go into the nuance of it, essentially. To talk about it and, you know, just understand, you know, people just want to be loved in a way that's meaningful to them. And the way you're describing it, it sounds to me that it's meaningful to you, it's meaningful to the other people involved. And, you know, and in the words of my wonderful brother, it's their garden, their path.
Yeah. Or not my monkeys, not my circus, I often say. It is, and I think this is why I like to talk openly about all this.
Yeah, I'm grateful you did, mate, because it's so often it's not what we picture, you know.
Yeah, and it's these ideas of that I've had to unlearn in my life. You know, what are the things that I have learnt? What are the rules of life? You know, the book is called The New Rule Book. But what I do in that book is I don't tell you how to live, but I am telling you to question the rules that are telling you how you should live. And that's what I'm inviting. So when I talk about, you know, having two partners, when I talk about being non-monogamous, when I talk about, you know, these things that for some people might absolutely seem anything from sinful to wrong to challenging to difficult, but for some people, me talking about it also validates it, as if that is a thing that works for you, that's okay too. And it's just like, you know, monogamy, if that is a thing that works for you, then absolutely you should do that. If marriage is a thing that works for you, absolutely you should do that. If having kids works for you, absolutely you should do that. But we do have to question a culture that tells us that there's only one way to live, and no matter who you are, that way to live is the way that you will be happy. Because I see, as a psychologist, I see the outcome of that when someone is forced to live in a way that does not align with who they are, whether that be their gender, their sexuality, the kind of work they want to have, the kind of family they want to have, whatever it is. When we are forced and don't question a culture that tells us that we have to be a particular way, that leads to anxiety, depression, suicidality, self-harm. I see that end. So I have, that's very present when I talk about these sort of things openly, is because I want to let people know that if you are doing something with consent, if you are doing something where you are being authentic to yourself and you're doing something that is not a risk to those people around you, and if you're doing something that allows you to live authentically in a way that allows you to be well, then that's okay. And you should do everything you can to get the support around you to question the expectations around you that are telling you that there's only one way to live.
That you put that so wonderfully. I have nothing to add to that, Chris. Thank you very, very much.
A moment away from Chris to say that if this episode is working for you, if you're hearing something in this episode that is resonating, if you're hearing something that's in this episode that you're like, you know what, that person should hear it, please, you can really support us here at the show by telling another person about it. Send it to someone, text it to someone, share it on your socials, repost it, however you do. If you don't feel like sharing it with a person, if you like it, if you rate it, if you subscribe to it, if you leave a review, wherever you're listening to this, all that stuff really helps another person, probably someone you don't know, getting the same value you're getting out of this podcast. And I know people get a lot of value out of this podcast because I read my emails and I read the Discord. So thank you. That really helps us. That all goes to supporting us here at the show. Back in a moment with a bit more from Chris Gears.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You mentioned earlier completing the stress cycle. I'm very happy to say that I've been through some extraordinary sessions of Hakomi therapy, which is physically playing out the missed part of a trauma response. And I've found great, extraordinary practitioner who worked me through it. But I found great relief and great freedom in that. And I'm very much aware, like if I need to exercise. I need to move my body to, as I say, give myself the gift of the hormones that I need to shift mood states throughout the day. Tell me, when it comes to bodies and, not, as we mentioned before, not everyone is similarly abled. When it comes to bodies, what role does the body, this kind of spacesuit that we have, what role does that play? And what have we maybe, not got kind of 100% right in the past, and what's the way we could move forward when thinking about our bodies?
I think that question, what role does the body play in mental health? I think we even need to sort of reframe the question because it's already, mm-hmm. it's already putting the body as if it's this separate thing to mental health.
Yeah. And you're right. Yeah,
it's
right.
All the one system. And I think that's the main thing that I invite us to reframe. And psychology as a discipline, and psychologists have been the worst at this mm-hmm. than anyone, to separate mind and body.
Yeah. If you follow the nerve endings, my brain goes down to the ends of my toes. Like my brain is, it's not just in my skull. My brain is enormous. Like it's not just here.
It's not just up the top. And we think about it as if the mind is this separate thing. And if we're feeling stressed or whatever, if you go and see a psychologist, there's this idea that they're going to talk, you're going to talk, and it's going to cause you to think differently. And thinking differently is going to change your mental health and well-being. The problem there is that, it's not thinking changes your body or body changes. It's just all one system. And what I mean by that is what we do with our body changes our mental health and well-being. How we change our thoughts changes our body. These things, systems just all interact. It's all the one thing. So rather than, I try to almost not use the term mental health anymore or physical health. I just like to talk about health.
It's just health.
What are you doing for your health? And we exercise or nourishment and pleasure and all these things we can do with our body, they improve our health, you know? And yes, that might improve our mental state and all these sorts of things, but it's just about what are we doing to improve our health? And I think what happens time and time again, because of the culture we survive, or, you know, we survive in, that's what it feels like sometimes. We're just surviving in this culture when it comes to body that is not telling us that our bodies and its signals are things we should listen to know what we need to do for our health. But rather, we sort of learn that our body and its signals are selfish, sinful things that we need to ignore. You know, when our body is hungry or when our body wants something, you know, if we grow up in a diet culture, we're told to like ignore that or that that's wrong, we should get rid of it. If our body needs to rest and we're in a culture that is telling us to work, 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 you will separate and ignore that signal. Time and time again, we just sort of grow up in this culture that causes us to disconnect from our body in order to live the life that we're meant to be living. And what I would invite people to do, and what the book, I try to really invite people to take the space to, like listening to our emotions, to listen to our body, to trust our body. You know, sometimes when I say that, you know, listen to when your body needs to eat, listen to when your body needs to rest. I think about being a kid is when the last time we probably did that, right? You know, when we were a kid, we used to maybe eat when we were hungry, or, you know, a baby would cry when it needs milk, or, you know, when a kid gets upset, they need to nap, you would nap. You know, there was this
Wolfie will stop playing, get up and lie on the couch and go, I'm going to play later. Okay.
Yeah. And has the freedom to do that. And it's so good. So good for body, to listen to body, to listen to what you need. But then we go to school, and school is often the first time when we are told we can only eat at certain times of the day with the bell.
Yeah.
You know, it changes when we can sleep, when we have to wake up. It suddenly we start to see the day as, you know, work and play. Play should becomes this thing you can only do at certain times. Play should be something you can do whenever you need, just like nourishment, just like rest. But we don't have a culture that's created this. So it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time and often acting against a lot of expectation to actually listen to your body and what it needs. And I invite people to think about that. When does your body need rest and how do you do that? And not only that, how do you create a life that allows you to rest? How do you create a life that allows you to, you know, nourish your body? What does that look like? I use the word nourish there to think about, you know, food and everything. But what is nourishment looks like for you? What does pleasure look like for you in your body? What do you do that allows your body to feel good? And rather than what we, I think, find time and time again, is it's almost like our bodies, the culture that we survive tells us that our bodies need to be the ticket to greater success through how it looks, through getting a particular body shape, through losing weight, through getting a six pack, through getting whatever it is that you have learned that body will make me successful or that body will bring me happiness. So all of a sudden, our bodies don't become this thing that we must listen to know what it needs. Our bodies just become this thing that we need to operate and move in a particular way to lose weight or to look a particular way, or in order to, if they become this thing, this means to become successful. And it takes a lot of work, but that's where I think we need to be, is actually not viewing our body as something that we need to use in order to be successful, to look a particular way, but actually, how can we trust our body again to listen to what it needs? And how can we create the life where we give our body the pleasure it needs, the nourishment it needs, the rest it needs? Because it's really hard to do that kind of work. But if we go back to that idea of self-care, self-care kind of gets this idea sometimes that it should be something that feels good, you know, that when you do self-care, it should feel good. That makes sense to me. The problem is that's not self-care that we all need most of the time. The self-care we need most of the time feels really hard because it's often about saying no to something to allow you to rest, or it's often about doing something that your body needs rather than what work needs or what a partner needs from you right now. If that's your idea of self-care, then that's a good thing, I think, when we can start to be guided by our body's needs and rise up against those expectations around us that are telling us that we can't rest right now.
I certainly don't think that anyone would you know, certainly in a relationship with that person, and I use relationship in the sense of like it might be your employee or it might be your boss, it might be your kid, your mate. No one's going to go, no, you can't look after yourself. You know, everyone's going to go, sure, man. Like, but we have this idea that we can't do it, that we're letting people down. But you know, if that's all you do, maybe. You know,
we also, I don't think, have a culture that rewards people that look after their body. We have a culture that rewards people who are successful or who are doing what's expected. I'm reading The Myth of Normal at the moment by Gabor Mate, which is an incredible book where he questions what is normal, basically, the myth of normal, this idea that if we just live normal, then we will be happy and we will be great. And he sort of questions, well, hang on, just because something is normal doesn't mean it's what we need. And I think about this with the relationship between body and sort of work all the time, is that there's this expectation around us to do a lot. You know, life kind of sets up all these ideas about what we must do and what must be expected of us. But if we can question that normal and realize that just because it's popular, just because everyone's doing it, doesn't mean it's what we need right now. And go instead to that place of thinking, you know, no, what do I need and how can I create that? I think we can start to develop something that is good for our mental health and well-being. And this was really the hardest bit about reading this book, is that it lists the kind of personality type that is rewarded in society. So that personality type is someone who does for other people before themselves, who works to expectation, who does what's required, you know, who does what's expected at the cost of themselves. That's the kind of personality that is rewarded. And you think about it, that is the kind of person that achieves great success in work often and in academic success. And all these, they kind of define the success. But that personality type is exactly the same personality type that leads to more likely to have cancer, more likely to have heart disease, more likely to be unwell, more likely to be immunocompromised, more likely to have anxiety, depression. And I'm certainly not saying that cancer is just caused by personality type. But it is also true when you look at the evidence that how we act, if we are always acting in a way that puts our work's needs, other people's needs above what our body's needs, in the moment, it feels like you make the right decision when you do what your partner needs or when you do what work needs. But in the long term, it's going to lead to not only mental challenges down the path, but it's the kind of life that will lead to physiological and, you know, health challenges down the end as well.
There's so much in this book, and I'm sure, you know, what I really like about it and when I read it is that for what it is, it's pretty short.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that extraordinary book, Beyond the Gender Binary by Alok Vadmenon. It's like, I said to them, it's like, how did you get this at like 5,000 words? What did you do? And they said, like, I needed it to be something someone could read in an hour and a half. Like, that they distilled it. And what you've done is it makes it accessible, because so often the things that you speak about in this book, they're protected by academic language. They're protected by hoity-toityness. You know, this idea that, oh, no, you can't understand these. Honestly, even down to the way that the information is presented, mate, the fonts you choose, the colors, like, it doesn't come across as, you know, some of the many books that I've read that are just dense 600-page long things with tables in them, which have brought me great relief. Yeah. But fuck me, it's hard work getting through it. So I appreciate very much that you have also seen the way that you've conveyed your message along. So look, it's a cracker, mate, and I'm just grateful that you did it and grateful that you put this out there, because it's something that can really help a ton of people. I'm really, like, good on you. Bloody great stuff, man.
And how it looked and how it was going to be presented was so important to me, because I wanted something that looked like a gift book or would be something beautiful, but then would secretly actually really challenge people. It's a complex book that is dealing with how we can define a meaningful life and how we can love. And, you know, when my publishers, you know, first saw the draft, they're like, this is big. Like, I think they're expecting, you know, quite a simple kind of mental health guide. But life is complex, and how to love, how to define a meaningful life, how to process emotion, you know, how to build a relationship with your body. These things are complex. And I wanted to make sure that the complexity was there, but it was presented in a way that was accessible and felt easy. And so it was almost like this manifesto for like how to live a meaningful life, masquerading as a gift book, is kind of where I think it sort of ended up. Because the beauty of that is it hopefully becomes this thing that not only will it feel accessible and inclusive because I've written it in a way that's inclusive for all sexualities, for all genders, but also it's accessible, inclusive, just in the sense that it feels easy. You know, it feels nice to pick up, feels easy to read. That was really important to me because it, you know, it should feel enticing and easy. But I hopefully it's the kind of book that it kind of gets you in because it seems easy and it seems beautiful, and you might buy it for your friends and family because it looks beautiful. Yeah. But then I want it to start really important, complex, challenging conversations because it's dealing with heavy stuff, hopefully in a really, really beautiful, accessible way.
It's a cracker, mate. Thanks so much for the effort it took to make it. And thanks so much for being so generous with me today. And I'm really, really grateful for your time, man.
I'm really grateful for the space. Thanks so much.
That was psychologist Chris Cheers. The new work that he has written is called The New Rulebook. It's a book called The New Rulebook. It's a great read. He sent me an early copy and I was lucky enough to be a part of the pre-publishing of that. And it's a good book. I like it. It's a great read. And it's out right now. If you want to come see us live for this Friday, we're at the Factory Theatre in Marrickville, bringing NTNN, NNN, the real stories and the fake news. It's just a news show. It's the news you watch anyway. Well, you don't watch the news. I know that. So it's the news of the day, but told in a way that you've never seen it before. It's hilarious. It's fun. It's dangerous. There's always a special guest. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And it's great. And I'd love you to come. Come check it out. The tickets are in the show notes. You can also find in the show notes, you can find details for the June the 3rd show, which is in the Newcastle Comedy Festival. We're on in the afternoon, 5:30 in the Arvo. So Heggy's doing a gig later that day. And I think Midflight Brawl are on before us. So look, I know there's three gigs you can check out that I'm a fan of my gig, but I'm also a fan of Midflight Brawl and a big fan of Heggy, as you know. So come check it out. The Newcastle Comedy Festival, wherever you are in the New South Wales area. It might be easier for you to get there than get to Sydney. June 3rd in the afternoon. Tickets are in the show notes for that as well. If you want to get in touch with me, super easy. Find me on email, sendotteremail@gmail.com. You can also grab me on the Discord server. The links to those things are all in the show notes. Big thanks to everyone that helped me make the show today. Bruce Steele on research and support. Toe Hider on the music. Addy Ma on audio and video post-production. And Rachel Barrett, the great and powerful organiser of everything. Thank you so much for being a part of it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you Wednesday. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.